I am Ann Peterson, and I teach at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I have now been here a week. How many of you are new to the to these sessions? Okay, all right. We have spent the week, though each session is discreet. You don't need to have been here all week without feeling like you can't participate or find something that you can think about. My background is, my undergraduate degree is in music. So I've had lots of interest and love in music. I was trained really classically as a flutist and pianist. And then to make my way through graduate school for part-time work, I taught flute and piano in Catholic schools where my husband Gary was the musician. And then I feel like I do, like pastors do continuing ed, I do mine sort of through osmosis by living with a musician and going to lots of concerts and lots of marching band workshops and lots of different events. And we also have been playing in a folk group, in a worship setting in a Roman Catholic congregation for the last 7 years. There's only one sort of musical group at our Lutheran church, and there's no chance in the place below of breaking into that group. So we were asked to join a Catholic group, and we've been really enjoying that. It gives us a real different sense of ecumenical participation, and I think we've really, really valued that experience. So with Gary teaching in Catholic schools for 10 years and then worshiping, and we've been on the worship and arts boards at the Catholic Church and involved in the diocesan worships, we're getting ready for a big Jubilee 2000. Gary's doing a bunch of arranging for a huge event that the diocese is having when we get down. So my background has been both as a participant in the pews, as a worship leader in Roman Catholic and Lutheran settings, primarily Catholic. But I also have a fair amount of background. I did my doctorate on Luther. So I also bring to the discussion a fair amount of interest in what Luther might have to say about worship. This week we've spent time talking about jazz and the blues, which is a foreign art form for me in terms of my uneasiness at playing it. I love listening to it, and Gary helped me out in several sessions about how the theme of improvisation might be a model for understanding God in the world. And we spent the last session looking at the blues and also at jazz. And what we find as you look at the structure of jazz and blues is improv often, I think, gets the bad name that it's just whatever goes. Improv is just standing up and doing your own thing. Well, when you study improv and have a high school band director teach improv to us this last week, you realize how highly structured improvisation is. And particularly, we noticed that last night with the 12-bar blues. Very repetitive structures that work over and over, come on in, that work over and over again to give strong, deep continuity in the jazz. I'm just doing a little summary from this week, so just feel free to keep coming in. So what we're going to do tonight is to pick up this theme of improvisation, but I want to do it by starting in a little bit different place to look first at what is the culture of worship in our congregations. What's happening in your congregations? What's happening in mine? Just to sort of get a feel for what I would call the landscape or the culture or the issues that are present in the liturgy and your worship experience. Secondly, I think some of those same issues were alive and well in Luther's time, and I want to talk a little bit, just as a historical example, about somebody who instituted radical liturgical reform. And Luther struggled as a reformer with how people would handle these great changes that came in the liturgy. And I have some material to share with you on that, as well as to look at Philip Melanchthon, who's the other great reformer. In fact, most of the writings that Lutherans really have as their background and foundation for being Lutheran are not Luther, but they're Melanchthons. So we'll look at Philip Melanchthon just very briefly to talk about what he thinks what worship is and what the book of the Lutheran Confessions, that fat book that you read in seminary and look at about being a Lutheran. And we'll end up with asking you and my suggestions for what improvisational worship might look like. I have 5 different points, but you might well have others that you might suggest for what improvisational worship might be like. So I'd like to start with this by reading a quote. There's a book out on worship. I have sort of mixed feelings about it. I'd be interested maybe after the session, if anybody's read it, to get some feedback on it. I have not heard Marva Don do her sessions. I know she was the keynote for South Dakota Synod this year. And I picked up her new book. She's a theologian. It's called Reaching Out Without Dumbing Down, A Theology of Worship for the Turn of the Century Culture. And she's trying to look at how we can overcome this, the problems in worship in our congregations, one being the traditional versus the contemporary, the other just how we do worship. So at the beginning of this book, there's a foreword in it by Martin Marty with a quote that he takes from Annie Dillard. And I'd like to read this quote from Annie Dillard. She said, "Since we," in quotes, "have been doing this liturgy for the last 2,000 years, why can't we seem to do it as well as a high school drama club cast can do after 6 weeks of rehearsing a play?" A little jab there. "Not that worship is nothing but rehearsable performance, and not that a high school play is worship, though drama and liturgy do have some common roots. But people who attend services of prayer and praise, song and action, preaching and the sacraments, often have to endure mumbling and stumbling, which are off-putting. This is not how God is to be praised, and this is not what worshipers will put up with for indefinite periods to come." I just thought that was kind of interesting, because I think worship can, we've been doing this for 2,000 years, but sometimes when I go on Sunday mornings, I feel like that's the place that's gotten the least attention from the congregation, from the pastors. So I worked with someone who, I won't even give you a clue in what context, years ago, who said, "Well, I plan the sermon by looking at the bulletin on the way up in the morning to the pulpit." So, heard a gasp up there. Yeah, it was an amazing year for me. But anyway, I think that kind of gets at what Marva Don is trying to raise in this book. So I wrote down 3 different areas of issues that I think are present in worship, and I'm going to pass out these handouts for you. They've been picked up over the week, so you'll need to share them. But there's a section in there of quotes on worship toward the back. You need to kind of root through a little bit until you get to about the back 4th page, and it will say worship and liturgy. Let me start with you, though, and find out just what you think some of the current issues, problems, possibilities, excitements, what's happening in your congregational life in worship? Yes?
Well, there are 20 of us here from the Lutheran Church in Madison, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. Lake Ridge Lutheran, and I think all of us that are here of that group are very happy to find that we are a group who is very open to different kinds of worship. And not only the Green Book of Worship, but we used Hogan's, and we've had used Ray McKeever's worship services. And while some of us just think that's wonderful, there are certain people in the congregation who won't come if those are particularly McKeever's, because it's just too modern for them.
Okay.
But we have a choir, and then we have a contemporary Living Stone group, which sings much more music that's like that. And we feel through that we reach a broader cross of people that that inspires them.
Okay, so in part the question of how to include more people, worship styles, and sensing that there might be some conflict in your congregation between those who feel that certain styles are not helpful for worship, but at the same time trying to have different kinds of music and worship styles to reach other people.
But you find too, the longer it's done, the more they accept it too.
Okay. So. Good.
If the question is, what is the culture of worship? The culture certain in the congregation certainly sees worship as the prime activity of the church.
Okay.
I mean, still more people are there in the church building on Sunday mornings than any other time of the week.
Okay, so it's still the heart and center of the congregation. Okay. What other kinds of issues or concerns might or experiences that do you bring with worship?
Yes. Our congregation, everything is printed in the bulletin, so we have this massive bulletin with the liturgy and all this, and it's really created kind of a conflict between those who say, this is a waste of paper, and which I'm one of those, but being told that this is the way the church is going, and to make it user-friendly for visitors.
Okay.
That's what our pastor has gone toward as well. Although he is pretty good about not using massive amounts of paper. And
when you have, 12, 18, 20 pages.
Oh, geez.
We don't have that much. He cuts it down, and it's doesn't use all of the liturgy every Sunday. And that's important. That's why he likes to put everything, partly to make it user-friendly to people that aren't there all the time, so they don't have to switch back and forth, because we use the Lutheran Book of Worship, and we use the With One Voice.
Okay.
And sometimes we use some contemporary songs, and so then those can be right in the bulletin. And then he also puts we put the words of the songs, but we don't put all the music in. But we have the numbers of the hymns if they're in the blue or the green book, so that they can look them up if they need music and so on. But I wrestle with the same thing, except that I think our pastor has done a good job of not making it massive amounts, and so it doesn't seem like a real waste of paper. But I understand the reason, and I think it is important to reach out, and that's that reaching out, the dumbing down, but you're trying to help them get through without feeling uncomfortable.
Right.
Being a physically challenged person, I can tell you that balancing three books is awful.
Yeah.
I have difficulty balancing the green book, so I like the smaller book just because it's easier for me to hold. But boy, I really like congregations that go to have it for me all in the bulletin, then I can manage it very well.
One nice thing about worshiping at the Catholic Church is they don't use a bulletin. They just know the liturgy. So that's another odd sort of thing, is we have this strange sort of experience of going one Sunday to our Lutheran church where everything's printed out, and then we go the next Sunday. And see, there are advantages and disadvantages, because some of my students who visit, I have them go to this Catholic congregation, they say, well, we don't know the liturgy that well, so maybe we don't feel very comfortable. But the Catholic tradition has been that the parts of the Mass stay the same, the same words. Now they use different music. I mean, every week we don't know whether we're going to get a polka Mass or a cantor or a folk group or whatever, but we don't fumble with lots of books. I mean, the book's there if you need it, and you can pick that up. But it does feel different. And now I even know the Catholic liturgy, well, it's so similar to the Lutheran, it's so similar to the Anglican, that, we were in England this last year, and I can worship with Anglicans or Lutherans and feel really at home. But all these kinds of questions about what is worship for, who does the worship, what should worship have in it, I think raises questions that indirectly we've talked about all this week with improvisation, which is one thing we've learned about improv is that it's a blending of structure and novelty. Deanne used the language of familiarity and that which is new. And I think that's the struggle the church has had. We're not alone in this. And when we step back a little bit and look at Luther's situation, we'll find that many of those same issues Luther struggled with historically as well. How do you, what is our 12-bar blues pattern? So
I think that's part of what we need to ask ourselves. In order to be freed to improvise, in other words, to try new things, what are we going to say are the structures that provide the continuity? And I think that's even up for grabs. We can talk about that toward the end, but I think that's part of the issue that happens, is how do we keep people grounded and yet have the freedom to be loose enough that they can do with what they have in a different way. A couple just concrete examples. I've mentioned this in a couple different settings, and I'll do it again. I think there's enough new people. 2 years ago, I was on sabbatical for 5 months. We had a little commuter relationship, and I went up to St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota. Some of you are nodding. You may know where that is. And I was at the Institute for Ecumenical and Cultural Research, made most famous recently in Kathleen Norris's book, The Cloister Walk. And spent time both in St. John's and St. Ben's in the worship setting. And St. John's was the most convenient because that's where our offices were and stuff. But what I really liked doing was sneaking over to St. Ben's. It was the women's community, and they had completely redone their sanctuary in the 1980s. And the story, if you ever get a chance to visit, I think Marcel Breuer's chapel at St. John's is by far the most famous of the two, but I think St. Ben's is the one that's most conducive to worship. Some of us used to call it one at St. John's Darth Vader Chapel. It's got these huge presiding chair that looks like it's gonna lift off, and everything's kind of dark and eerie. And I mean, it's beautiful, but it's massive concrete structures. And then we'd go over to St. Ben's, and everything, they'd had this traditional Baroque sanctuary with everything going one direction with the altar, and some people were horrified, but they tore all that out. They kept some of the stained glass, but ordered Bavarian clear glass for the upper windows, and then painted everything in sort of light earthen pastels and light colors, sandblasted the coating off the pillars down to the original granite and some of the rock, so that when you walk in there, there's all this natural light and color. And one of the sisters, Sister Mary Anthony Wagner, who was one of the innovators for this project, who was in her 80s, came up and gave us a tour. And she talked about one of my favorite stories. She said, you see the presider's place up at that church. They always referred to it as up there at St. John's. And she'd say, now look at our presider's chair. And it was this little tiny thing that was at the same level as the women. In other words, they weren't going to have the priest elevated way above everybody else, but the priest sat with everybody else. And it was a magnificent statement about holding. I mean, they still have very much grounded in the tradition of their Benedictine, but they did some pretty radical things. And we're noticed for that. And there's a wonderful relationship between St. Ben's and St. John's. They have real lovely reciprocal relations, but they had been very intentional about their worship setting. And when you worship there, I always had this sort of strange sense of a community of women, about 200 women who are together day after day after day, but do some unbelievably new things with worship. Dolores Dufner, whose hymns we've already sung up here once, is the director of the music at St. Ben's. And it's just, I don't know, for one thing, I'd never worshiped with women all the time. And there were hardly any men at these services. And that's not a comment one way or the other than I've never had that experience. And it was really powerful to hear these women's voices and watch how they led worship. Okay, I'd like you to look at your worship sheets with me a minute to talk a little bit more about some of these issues that you brought up. Styles, I put under the category, at least in my home congregation, it's gone from more than worship styles to what I would label as worship war. They were even on the front page of the Argus Leader in Sioux Falls for their pulling apart of worship styles. When we came, it was, I think, at the peak of some of the problems. Gary and I played in folk groups for years and wanted to be a part of, we'd help out with the contemporary worship, whatever, but that was not going to be an option. So we've sort of moved in and out of these two, what I think are very distinct congregations within the umbrella of one congregation. There's the contemporary crowd, which has their own music and their own worship setting, and then the traditional crowd. In general, it's tended to be an age, somewhat age split too, though not completely. But it has, in many ways, I think, torn the church to shreds. And we have been, I think, horrified at some of the things that happen because of the splits in this congregation. And on that page, about the third quote down, Marva Dunn says, "Even in the church, and especially in the worship wars, we see what Lash calls the fashionable sneer that now automatically greets every loving recollection of the past. As if you kind of, anything that's old, you sort of have to go, well, we're not going to do that anymore and throw it out. And that exploits the prejudices of a pseudo-progressive society. Historically, however, we know that many radical movements drew strength and sustenance from the myth or memory of the past." To be radical, right, means to be, the root of that word is radix, which is root. And that's what makes these Benedictine sisters able to tell the abbot, we don't want the priest for that Sunday, because they're so strongly rooted in what they understand to be the gospel of Christ. Then I think she says it even more clearly in the next sentence. Again, we see the critical need for a very dialectical balance. Keeping the heritage of the faith and offering it in new forms that are still faithful. And I don't think this is something we're going to solve tonight, but I think it's struggling with how do we do that? There's an opening in our congregation right now for a music minister, somebody who will come in to take over the whole music program. And I know the organist and one of the senior pastors asked both of us, oddly enough, if I would apply at one point, if my husband would apply. And I said, well, I don't think you'd want me, because what I would do is come in and I'd start over. We wouldn't have traditional or contemporary. We'd scrap the whole darn mess and start over. Mm-hmm. And because I think part of the danger is that we can't seem to get out of this dilemma. And one thing I've seen this Catholic church that we belong to, one way they avoid that is you don't know what you're going to get on Sunday morning musically. It's always liturgical. Their attempt is for the music to lead worship, but you don't know whether you're going to get a guitar, a piano, a whatever. And that way people aren't coming just so they can hear whatever sort of music that they want. And there's enough rotation that, you know, if you go to church once a week, you're bound to get something that you like within the week or two. So it's an interesting way of, I think, sort of trying to work through some of these kinds of issues. Then the next quote from her, "We must ask if church effectiveness and preserved traditions are mutually exclusive, and whether traditions prevent creativity." We've looked very carefully this week how tradition actually enables creativity. That what happens in the 12-bar blues, what happens in jazz, is that the blues are rooted in a long and deep tradition of the spirituals from the African-American culture, centuries of a tradition, and this actually frees people up to be creative. "What is lost in the process if we throw away tradition simply for the sake of success and novelty?" Okay, so that's sort of one issue, the style issue. Another issue I put up encompasses maybe this question of user-friendly. How do we make worship? Up here, I've appreciated the word expansive, because I think inclusive already is getting a bad name. That seems sort of horrifying, but how do we begin to look at who's participating in worship? And how do we invite people into worship who are not part of, maybe they haven't been born, bred, and raised in the Lutheran Church for 100 years. How do you make worship accessible, and yet how do you make worship also meaningful? I think that goes to all kinds of issues, from language to, I have a little worship survey, it's about 30, 40 questions, and in my freshman religion class every year, my students have to attend 3 to 4 church services, and they bring their little survey with them, and they go to these different congregations, and they look at things like, you know, who's welcoming them? Is there something afterwards? Is the pastor using inclusive language? were they welcomed when they came? You know, and they kind of write up a little report and discuss how their experience of being a first-time participant in that congregation has been. And occasionally I save up little reports and send them to the area clergy that I feel comfortable with, that we've kind of talked through, well, so-and-so might be attending your church, are you open to hearing what they might have to say? And it's been kind of an enriching process on both ends. Students learn why certain things are done that maybe they misinterpreted. And that can very often happen. Things will be done that you're not familiar with, that may seem for one reason, and you find out later they weren't meant that way. But I think questions of how we open up, again, Holden for me is a time to refresh and renew. I've sung in different languages, in different styles. Last night it was wonderful to be freed up from any service book. I really appreciate that up here sometimes. I don't have to have something in front of me, but we learn what we need to along the way, and that can be very wonderful, especially when the focus is elsewhere. Then the last thing I put up there is the relationship to culture in a broader way, that is, to the market economy. One of my colleagues' kids are always saying, church is boring. We need it, it's boring, I don't want to go to church. And so the purpose of church should be to be entertaining. My fear at its worst in some sense is how we struggle with listening to our culture. What does our culture say? Paying attention to that, but also looking at the dangers of what we might fall into by accommodating worship solely to culture. Marva Don explains that just in that second quote a little bit. The contemporary demand to find a marketing niche actually threatens the Christian community. For the purpose of true worship is to offer God what would be pleasing to God. So this concern about, you know, are we selling out by doing liturgies that are slick, smooth, and entertaining? Gary and I find, you know, you get this kind of experience sometimes that feels just too easy, too slick. It's as if you're selling a product on Sunday morning to get people in the door. On the other hand, you don't want to lose people. So I think it's a really, I think we're in a really difficult position. And I only see these issues. I talk to my college students, and they're all over the map with this stuff. You know, it's, I think generationally, you can't just say, well, it's people who are in their 20s who want rock music. A lot of people, students at Augustana, want the traditional worship. So and some people who are in their 70s and 80s want jazz on Sunday morning. So I think it's dangerous to just label this as generational issues, so those do play in at some point. And finally, you know, hospitality to people who are outside the tradition. What's happening? I have a friend who grew up in the Roman Catholic Church, and she'd like to raise her daughter in the Lutheran Church. She's been baptized through Our Saviors, but every time she comes, the male language is so grating every Sunday that they just can't come. So, you know, questions I think that raise broad issues about what's the culture of worship. Okay. Any comments or questions at this point before we move to Luther?
I was just going to say, I received in the mail today an invitation to the Imaginative Church, it's called, an innovative, creative, one-of-a-kind conference experience designed for mainline pastors, held at the most imaginative place on earth, Walt Disney World Resort, Orlando. And it describes how to do worship that is motivated with Disney-proven approaches, is one of the key things. We talk about marketing, and at the heart of this are a couple of Lutherans, Dr. Walt Kallstad and Paul Sorensen from the Church of Joy. And it's, the word faithful appears nowhere. No sign of the basic shape of the historic liturgy. So you go here and you're given Disney hospitality and taught how to give that kind of hospitality in your church. And it feels blasphemous to me. It feels like in that pure marketing. the closest thing to Bible is empower you with essential biblical principles, which is about as far from Lutheran theology as you can get.
Exactly.
So this is...
You don't want that as a free gift after you leave Holden from the...
Yeah, that was tomorrow.
Yeah.
Anyway, but it's alive and well. Mm-hmm. And I just thought of it because you said slick and easy.
I appreciate that. That's a classic example of what I'm talking about. Nancy Sessions, here's this cross-fertilization going about the Disneyizing. I had the unfortunate experience of going to Disney World a couple years ago, and luckily I never got out of the hotel, but a strange place for the American Academy of Religion. 7,000 theologians go to Disney World. You remember that? Yeah, right. I mean, we sort of sat all week and said, there's something really wrong with this. You know, while we're spending $10 to $20 for a sandwich and a Diet Coke to sort of talk about what religion means. And it's that same fear that Nancy's watching that's happening with what we're teaching children, and, you know, every movie that comes out, every kid has to have every, you know, Disney thing. So that same sort of danger, I think, is really... We had a friend do an interim at a church in a state I won't mention, where they would come into the drive-in, right? You've heard of these places, the drive-in movie theater, and on Sunday morning, you know, it's if you're happy and you know it, honk your horn, and everybody'd honk their horn. And they'd bring communion out to the cars. I mean, it's just, I think blasphemy is about the only word for it. It makes me sick. So that kind of just jettisoning of anything that we know as who we are, and saying, well, you know, if it's going to sell, let's go for it. So, and that's why I get nervous about church growth. You know, maybe it's time to lose a few members. I don't know. I'm going to get on a soapbox here, but yes.
Yeah, you know, my understanding of worship is that worship is work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think too often we don't approach it that way. And so we have a tendency to think, now how are we going to satisfy all these people's whims about what they need? Rather, we're attempting to need to have an understanding of the corporate nature of worship, that together we are doing this. And I think one of the best ways to do that is to make sure there's consistency and structure.
Right.
When Aaron and I went to Mass in St. Peter's in Rome, it was all in Italian Latin. I knew exactly what was going on.
Yeah, right.
I
sure.
was at home.
Yeah, or you can
and
be
that
in.
That can happen whether it happens to be a jazz mode,
right,
or a 17th century Lutheran mode, or whatever. And if we, I think, are faithful enough to our people, to make sure the structure, and I think that's why, you know, the Catholics, whether they're doing a guitar mass or doing something else,
right,
those folks know from Sunday to Sunday what the structure's going to be.
Right.
Music may be different. I may cringe a little bit over it.
Sure. Sure.
I've cringed over a lot of Lutheran stuff.
Yeah, me too.
You know, so, but I think structure is important, in the fact that this isn't entertaining. Worship has never been meant to
be entertaining. I agree with you. Absolutely, yes.
I was curious when you said if they hired you and you would jettison and do something new, and have you thought that through?
No, I think it was just a gut reaction of trying to figure out how some place that's become so polarized, and I struggle with this in other settings, but one way I think is for people to give up their turf. We found out that one of the issues around the worship is not only the styles, but who gets the 9 o'clock time. I mean, that's where the 9:30 time is the most popular time, and nobody will budge. So that we have a wonderful new pastor, Nadine Lair, who said, you know, I've tried to do some international settings with more international music and some different things. But nobody will, the 11 o'clock traditional people won't budge, the 9 o'clock contemporary people won't budge. So part of my suggestion was just to say, well, nobody gets what they want for a year, and we're just going to do something like Marty Haugen's Eucharistic service and start over. I mean, I think I would try to find something that had a kind of a blend of both, and just say for a year you all get to take a sabbatical and we'll do something, you know, maybe we'll join the Benedictines and do the Psalms every week. I don't know. I haven't thought that through, but I think it would be a way of sort of saying that people who've had their knit, so to speak, on certain issues could, for a year, take a leave.
With all the losing.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And then you could maybe go back and say, now that you've had a year off from all this, how would you think again? Mm-hmm. So, yes.
I think it's kind of, some congregations, the way they try to handle some of that is to have sort of the off service, you know, not the times as the time where they bring in the innovation. Interestingly, in my hometown congregation, they have a Saturday evening service. And so that's where they thought they would put the contemporary, or they put whatever they were going to do, but it turned out that it was all the elderly people that were attending that service. And it didn't go.
But, okay.
You know, it was not the younger ones that were.
Now, those things are pretty unpredictable. It's hard to kind of... everything you've been talking about for me was interesting to go back, and I did some reading on Luther and what Luther was about. And I'd like you to go to the next page of these little quotes. Just off the top of your head, from your background or memory of Luther, what liturgical reforms did Luther institute? Singing. And... Language of who?
The
common people, right. And of course, Luther's translation of the Bible is still the foundation for the German language. So translating it into the vernacular so that the people now had parts instead of just the priests sort of chanting it all the time in Latin. What else?
Communion in both kinds.
Communion in both kinds. That's another very important liturgical reform. Okay, and some changes in the Mass. It's really fun to read Luther's commentary. Some of these are taken from his commentaries on the Deutsche Messe, that is the German Mass. And in that Mass, you go up twice for communion. You go up for the bread, and then you come back and you sit back down, and then you go up again for the wine. And just about his own thinking through liturgical reform. So here he says at the top, now keep this quote in mind to somebody who's just done liturgical reform that changes the whole tradition. He says, nor did I make any innovations in the Mass, for I have been hesitant and fearful, partly because of the weak in faith, who cannot suddenly exchange an old and unaccustomed order of worship for a new and unusual one, and more so because of the fickle and fastidious spirits, here's Luther, who rush in like unclean swine without faith or reason, and who delight in novelty and tire of it just as quickly when it is worn off. Such people are a nuisance, even in other affairs, but in spiritual matters, they are absolutely unbearable. Yeah, doesn't it? I mean, I can just hear a lot of us wanting to say that. So Luther's really struggling with this as a pastoral issue. Worship is a pastoral issue. And I think Luther didn't make structural changes in the Mass. I think that's really interesting to know. The basic structure was kept. The changes that came had to do with who was doing the Mass and why you were doing the Mass. Then on worship in the marketplace, Luther. And what shall I say of the external additions of vestments, vessels, candles, the palls of organs, and add the music and of images? There was scarcely a craft in all the world that did not depend on the Mass for a large part of its business. So, you know, here he's saying, just as we are, you know, there was the Disneyland in Luther's time in which every business was somehow getting their goods from the Mass, right? Selling. It was a profitable industry. And then Luther goes on to say, so the kingdom of God is not any right, but faith within you. And we'll come back to that, I think, a little bit. The next part, his preface for the German of the Deutsche Messe. In the first place, I would kindly and for God's sake request that all those who see this order of service or desire to follow it, do not make it a rigid law to bind or entangle anyone's conscience, but use it as Christian liberty, as long, where, when, and how you find it to be practical and useful. Again, you know, what he does in sort of changing things a bit in the Deutsche Messe, not to do things in order to bind one's conscience, one way or the other. Anytime something, I think, becomes for Luther, law or binding one's conscience, then maybe you've missed the point in the worship. Particularly if you have to do a certain thing a certain way, or it's not really worship. So again, these comments I think are coming pastorally from somebody who's in the congregation. I just loved going to Luther's, to the Stadtkirche in Wittenberg, to the city church, this wonderful church where we could see where Luther had preached. Then on the issue of the vernacular, here goes his sarcasm again. The Holy Spirit did not act like that in the beginning. That is, he did not wait till all the world came to Jerusalem and studied Hebrew. Here he's talking about as if everybody should study Latin. But gave manifold tongues for the office of the ministry so that the apostles could preach wherever they might go. I prefer to follow this example. It is also reasonable that the young should be trained in many languages. For who knows how God may use them in times to come. For this purpose our schools were founded. While teaching in a Lutheran college were failing miserably, we allow them to take 1 year of a language and then half of them cut out a half with their wild card substitute. So my little dig back. But you can see what he's talking about, the vernacular, that multiple languages, multiple metaphors. Luther was one who had rich poetry, rich metaphor in his worship. That's why his hymns, I think, have stayed so long. And I was told it was probably a myth that Luther actually took bar tunes, went down to the local tavern and composed A Mighty Fortress. They were probably songs, part of his culture, but whether or not he actually, I don't know, we don't know, but he does draw on songs that were available to people that they knew and create them into hymns. Now, I just couldn't put his own comment about Germans, that's a needless insertion in there, but I thought it was amusing. And then finally, the last quote is sort of a contemporary Martin Luther. How many of you have read Joseph Sittler? Anybody in here familiar with Joseph Sittler? One of, I think, the greatest theologians of this century, finally finished his career at the University of Chicago Divinity School, and then sort of emeritus at the Lutheran School of Theology. And I would go and listen to Joseph Sittler. He was in his early 80s at that point. And he was blind by the time he was in his early 80s, and he would come and do these wonderful lectures. And I haven't checked to see if the library has any of Sittler's works, but my guess is that they do. This quote comes from his book called Gravity and Grace, which are very accessible essays written in kind of a prose style. His other book has Grace in the title, too. It's slipping my... But anyway, Gravity and Grace is probably the most accessible. And Sittler is saying this, and he sounds a little bit to me like a modern-day Luther. Traditional music settings had a variety of forms, but they were all characterized by gravity, or seriousness, depth. I am not sure you can be grave with the timebeats this generation likes. Now, remember, he's in his 80s. I remember an old Sam Johnson statement that the jollity of the clergy much displeased him. Well, much contemporary liturgy is just too jolly. Maybe we could substitute the word slick or entertaining. In the Christian faith, there is certainly a mood of celebration and thanksgiving, but when one gets beyond the age of 25 or so, the celebrative mood is no longer adequate to one's deepening awareness of life's ambiguities. We talked about that with the blues yesterday. Part of the power of the blues is that it tells about life as it is, right? It doesn't just gloss over pain and suffering, but it's rooted in the expression of pain and suffering. The God of our worship is indeed Lord of the dance, but there are non-danceable requirements that he is obliged to satisfy. So this jollification of the liturgy is an appropriate mode for some occasions. It is bitterly inappropriate for others. I think that's what Susan Briel was saying. There are times when we have made the liturgy like Disney. And he says bitterly inappropriate. We might use the word blasphemous. There is something in the old chants of the church that brought a necessary audible balance to the self-incurvature, incurvature of contemporary Christianity, and I very much lament its loss. So this is somebody who was again struggling with, and Sittler's hardly a theologian who was stuck in the past. In fact, he's usually criticized by a lot of people for being sort of too liberal. But this is somebody who wrestled with questions about how we preserve tradition and yet how we incorporate elements of novelty and newness. So the historic, we're rooted in a tradition that has struggled with its whole history. And Luther's little phrase, ecclesia semper reformanda, the church is always reforming, I think needs to be our grounding statement. In the church that I'm kind of participant in, you can go to two conferences, the Reforming Church Conference or the Call to Faithfulness. Well, you can guess which one I don't go to. But anyway, one can sort of round the wagons up, right? Build the fortress, say, well, the only thing to do in the church is just to dig in deeper. I think the sense of the church always being under the process of reformation, that is not jettisoning the tradition. Hardly what Luther did, hardly what Melanchthon does. Keeping the structure, keeping the tradition, but always asking to whom is it, to whom is the liturgy for? What is the liturgy about? Okay. Same question. How do we talk about an improvisational worship? We looked at this whole week, the characteristics of improv. It's always done in an ensemble. It's done in a cooperative or dialogical way. Gary talked about it as learning a language, that when one learns jazz, it's like learning another language. You have to practice the phrases and you have to do it constantly. Jazz musicians live and work and breathe and eat with other jazz musicians, if you really want to be a good jazz musician. When you first learn a language, I learned German only to read it for my doctoral exams. So when I went to Germany this fall, about the only thing I could remember were a few words in the Lutheran Confessions, you know, which is a horribly painful experience for finding out where the bathroom is. So you can understand when you learn a second language how important it is to be in the culture. I think if I spent a month or two, I would know German better than if I sat and read it at a distance. Okay. So here's my little laundry list of what I think improvisational worship is. And then I'd like to see if you would like to add or challenge or refute what I have to say. First of all, improvisational worship would be ecumenical and international in its scope. That is your experience. You could go to wherever in Rome or to, can't remember the name of the little church, it was Wordsworth's Church in Grafsmere, England, with about 100 of us on a Sunday morning in January. And my Roman Catholic students that were with me and my Lutheran students sat down and we felt right at home. But also international in focus, that is reaching out to the global community so that it belongs and participates in many different languages and in styles and in experiences of the gospel. Secondly, it's always reforming and transforming the tradition. That is constant conversation about what is the structure that we must have on Sunday morning. I think there are certain elements that I think are necessary, but I also think they need to be thought through and talked about. What does it mean to confess the creed? And you get up and you confess the Apostles' Creed. You might even do a whole series of worship services around asking what's the structure that gives us room to improvise. You could spend a whole church year doing something like that. Secondly, grounded in word and sacrament. That sounds so Lutheran. But for me to reframe it as the 12-bar blues pattern that undergirds us in such a way that proclamation of the word and celebration of the sacraments are kind of that 12-bar blues. I was telling Nancy the other night, I worked in a congregation for a while in the Twin Cities. Some of you may know Mount Olive Lutheran Church. Mark Cedio is a musician there now. When I worked there, they had this annual planning retreat for the congregational leaders. And we picked the hymn of the day, the text for the day, and the tentative sermon theme for an entire church year. And we took like a 4-day retreat to do that. Then it was published in a brochure and mailed out to the congregation members, with the hope that they would then prepare by looking up the hymn of the day, thinking through the ideas in the gospel text for that Sunday or the epistle or whatever the text was, and come to church already knowing that it was the first Sunday in Advent, that you might be singing, you know, so that you would be already in tune. And they did it very structurally according to the liturgical year. And then within that, there was all kinds of interesting freedom to move in and out with some really wonderful and different kinds of worship experiences. The fourth thing for me of improvisational worship is that it needs, we need to find a way of stronger lay leadership. I think it's absolutely essential that we allow people to do the liturgy and to do it well. A couple nights ago, we watched some of the village children who'd been up here all summer read the lessons. Gary and I have talked about the experience of working in a Catholic elementary school where the daily masses are done by the kids. So these K through 12 or K through 8 elementary kids at St. Gerald's were trained from the get-go about how to be liturgical leaders. So then when they got up to read the prayers or the text in front of the church, it wasn't, you know, so you couldn't hear anything. It was a wonderful sense of leadership already because they'd already been doing it in their fourth grade class all week. Or Paul Mons's and now Mark Cedillo's choir school that's been going for Saturdays year after year after year. Kids who are trained and think about how to lead the liturgy. So I think much deeper involvement in the church by leadership. And that means for clergy, learning how to think the best ways to involve people in the leadership. And that doesn't necessarily have to be just up front, but it can be in planning and thinking through and listening to the needs of the congregation. Because I think that sets up this whole notion that we've talked about in the jazz ensemble of a community kind of experience, where worship is much more of a dialogical process, a give and take, so that you get to know each other well enough, you kind of know what's coming, and maybe the music kind of hints one way, and the pastor will listen for one thing, and the congregation... A good example of that. How many of you know that when on a fifth verse of the hymn, what's that, Zimbelstern? That little thing goes whirling on the organ and sounds like that you stand up, right? Gary and I belong to this congregation. Everybody would stand up on this verse and we thought, what? Well, it was the doxological verse. So it took a couple times for us to look at the text that every time there was a Trinitarian verse, the Zimbelstern would go ballistic in the organ and we would stand up. And it took us a while in different congregations to not pop out of the pew when that verse came up. But it was kind of a neat little thing. The congregation knew how to do that. It was a little bit like the bass player taking the riff this time. They just kind of, it was kind of in their body. They knew when to get up and do these neat little things. And then the last piece for me about improvisational worship, and maybe the most important, is that worship's primary function is to equip Christians to serve the neighbor. I think for Luther, worship is virtually pointless unless it gets us out of the church and into the community. Mm-hmm. So to talk about that same function, I think, that we looked at in the blues, the whole purpose of the blues is to tell it like it is, to sing about the experience of people who've been oppressed in a way that helps them then rise out of that experience. It's not just standing to complain, but right, it's a strategy for how to go back in the world. So you come together, you sing the blues, but the blues itself is a means by which you then rise up out of that and are able to move into the world and live in a situation that may be less than ideal. We have about 5-10 minutes here. Those are kind of some of the things that have gone through my mind about how you look at a structure. And here I said nothing about music styles. I haven't said, well, I think you have to have so-and-so's setting of whatever. But you hear, I hope you hear a little bit of the struggle between some of these issues at the above. I may be too conservative for some and too liberal for others, but I think you have to start somewhere, and we come out as Lutherans, we're not Baptists, so we have to start at that point and look at our own resources, find out who we are. One of the best congregations that Gary and I worship at periodically in Sioux Falls is the Metropolitan Community Church, gay and lesbian congregation in town who have a real clear sense of identity and a real clear sense of mission. And they have lots of talk about worship because they struggle with those questions, the heart of who they are. It's the same with Mount Olive. The congregation that CDO belongs to has a strong outreach into the neighborhood, strong social ministry. So I think part of it comes out of the question about, well, who is the congregation? What are we doing? What's our primary focus in the community? Because otherwise, you just keep beating around the same bush again. Are we going to use Marty Haugen this week? Or are we going to use the Chicago Folk Service next week? Or are we going to use Martin Luther next week? Who cares if you don't know sort of what the heartbeat of your congregation is? So I would suggest starting with some really intentional discussion about who the congregation is and what they think their mission is. And out of that might grow some insights about what the worship might need to be then. I think it's really dangerous for the pastors to tell the congregation what it's going to be. So, yes? Oh, I'm sorry, I thought I saw it.
You can handle that.
Okay, yes.
I appreciated your last comment because you emphasized the macro in terms of the international and the ecumenical. Mm-hmm. But I think liturgy needs to deal with the personal issues mm-hmm. of people and of the community and help them relate those issues somehow to the faith. And so it needs both the macro, but it needs also the micro, the intimate, the relationships.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's nothing worse than going to worship on Sunday morning and feeling as if nobody there knows who you are. You know, sort of the lost... You know, you kind of go, sometimes, you know, you can go to a congregation, big or small, and say, well, this could be done in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, or Bozeman, Montana, it wouldn't matter, it's just kind of a liturgy. So I think you're absolutely right. Somehow the worship needs to have ownership about the experience of people in the pew. And that comes from a ministry from the whole congregation. It's not just the clergy's responsibility by any means, though leadership makes a difference. It's important that when you have an experience on Sunday morning of worship, you know why you're in this congregation and not another one. I think that makes a difference.
Hopefully you don't come out thinking, well, I could just as well have watched that on TV.
Right. Well, I could have just, you know... I'll admit that. Sometimes I assume home. Yeah.
I think a test might be, at the end of the liturgy, are you feeling more energy or less energy? Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Because what I find in some worship experiences, I end up feeling drained mm-hmm. at the end of the worship. And then I go to other kinds of worship, and I feel lifted up and energized mm-hmm. and ready to go.
It should be the start of your week. Yeah, it should prepare you for the week, not kill you off for the rest of the day. Right? Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
I was thinking of when you talked about mumbling through the service. Mm-hmm. I think that some of my most satisfactory types is when we've made changes. We make the change very intentional in mm-hmm. that we rehearse it together.
Right.
We practice apart. We get familiar with it. So there is a core of the congregation who is familiar and practiced with it. So then when the visitor comes or mm-hmm. people come incidentally, you know, you're carried along with there are certainly people that know this rather than feeling like everybody's mumbling and where are we?
Good comment. I think the person who's retiring at Our Saviors has done such a nice job of that. Don Leeson, who's introduced hymns on Sunday, and the sense of incorporating it week after week after week, and then the congregation, you're comfortable. I think it's like anything else, if it's just sort of inserted because it's new, and you never know why it's there, and you don't have a chance. I mean, some music, and that's the problem with any music. How many of you are not musicians? Yeah, I mean, if you're not a musician, music can also be really daunting. So anytime, whether it's a liturgical insertion, saying the creed in a new way, or singing a new song, I think it's important that people begin to sense that you've worked on this a while. That's why I like Annie Dillard's quote. I think you're right. Worship, in a way, is like a high school play. You know, drama and liturgy are very closely related. Yes?
I hear you talking mostly about, like, the care and nurturing of people already within a congregation. Mm-hmm. What do you see as our mission as a church to reach the unchurched mm-hmm. and people that don't have any traditions mm-hmm. at all to kind of have as a backbone to get them through a service and make it meaningful to them?
This is not my area, but I'll just speak more out of personal experience than anything. I remember going, we were looking at Lutheran churches to join in the Sioux Falls area, and I remember going to one. It was a baptism of our Lord Sunday, and somebody got up and talked about baptism that Sunday. The pastor had asked two lay people, and the person got up and said, well, I've been baptized 5 or 6 times. It doesn't really mean a whole lot to me, but this is an interesting, like, you know, that's not what you do, right? There's a bad example. I think part of that is finding out very specifically who your neighbors are. I know this Catholic church that we belong to has done very intentional research into the mission area. That is, who's the neighborhood that you're part of? Looking at socioeconomic issues, looking at racial issues. That's part of it, so that you kind of look at who's coming and who you need to bring in. Who would feel comfortable in your congregation? I think those are questions that need to be looked at. Looking at the mission of your church in the larger setting of the synod, of the national church, those are little issues. I have the baggage in my head of friends and colleagues particularly who find the church inhospitable because it's been so steeped in situations that for women have been particularly painful. And I think the Lutherans may be working through some of that, but leadership, who's doing the leadership? You know, I think all those kinds of issues, but I'm absolutely convinced that we need much more intentional conversation about it. And we need education. When I do adult forums at Lutheran congregations, the vast majority of us, and I'll put myself in that category, we don't know who we are. I mean, I think it's important to struggle with this question of who we are as Lutherans as part of the larger Christian community. And that's that tension about particularity and the broader identity. But we're not Baptists and we're not Catholics, so what does that mean? And how does that look in our liturgy?
I remember when I came from the Baptist church into St. Olaf first and mm-hmm. the Lutheran congregation, I already was interested in the church and so on, but I certainly would have welcomed a class or two on the liturgy and the practice and how to sing it and what it means, mm-hmm. because the Baptist church just didn't use the same terminology in the first place. Mm-hmm. Different stress.
Yes.
I was just trying to make a comment that, well, our society now is so far more pluralistic mm-hmm. than it had been a decade or two ago. And traditions that kept us focused to only the Lutherans or Baptists or Catholics
right.
or Norwegians or Germans
right.
or English. And now, of course, as I just was at a workshop with Tony Robinson, who wrote Good News in the Exile, he said in the Seattle area, there was one place, he now comes to the table in the community, the largest community, as one person at the table years before the Christian Church owned the table. Mm-hmm. And so to make it something available or friendly to all.
Right. I think one of the best words that Holden uses is trying to find a ministry of hospitality. And maybe that's the most concrete thing I can say. Part of the reason, and you can debate this in circles, part of the reason I love weekly Eucharist. And I sort of, when I went to our part of the country, began to starve to death because I couldn't find communion, but is that it's one place where we try to practice hospitality. And I think that's where the ELCA and where Lutherans can be particularly hospitable. We're not saying to Baptists or to Catholics or to other people, you can't come if you don't believe the way we do. It's an open invitation to participate in that fellowship. And there are wonderful ways to make the meal sort of the celebration, the feast, the way to say that anybody who comes into God's house is part of that meal. So I think any way that we could practice hospitality, whether it's at the Eucharistic table, whether it's when you first meet the pastor. Gary and I had this strange experience of looking at a congregation some time back and explained that for various reasons we don't have children. So then the pastor spent the whole evening taking us on a tour of the church, showing us all the nurseries and talking about the Sunday school program. Well, that wasn't a real hospitable gesture. You know, it's not that we're not interested in that, but we kept saying, well, we have other things that we could contribute to the church. So I think taking people where they're at and trying to be as receptive to and being really, I think we should invite people to come to a, you know, teachers have to get evaluated. The principal comes in and watches Gary every year. The dean watches my teaching. We need to get people in to say, you know, what's that worship service like? I think that sounds silly, but that's one thing. I think the ministry of hospitality is extraordinarily difficult, though. It's very easy to talk about, but do we really want, how hospitable do we really want to be? I think that's why Gary and I are so impressed with the hospitality at this Metropolitan Community Church. These are folks who are told by other churches that they're not welcome. You know, gay and lesbian, very open about who they are. They're not, they don't feel welcome, they don't feel, so when we come, we're just treated like royalty. I mean, I've never been at a place, maybe outside of Holden, where I'm just taken in and treated and just, you know, I'm not ordained. Would you celebrate, you know, I have a little struggle with this personally, but would you celebrate Eucharist for us? Well, okay. You know, I'd probably get in trouble with my synod, but since I'm not ordained anyway, they can't do anything to me. So, you know, we read the lessons, we do the music, we eat at the coffee hour afterwards, and it's a real mutual ministry. I mean, Gary and I have received such love and encouragement from this very small congregation, 30, 40 people. And I think that's because they know what it means to be welcomed into the body of Christ because they've been treated so unwelcome in other settings. And they know what it feels like. You know, so I think that's a place to start, is to ask those who we systematically exclude, well, what do you need to be welcomed into the church? And start there instead of sort of looking at the same faces again. I'm holding you over. It's 5 after. I need to let you go. If you're welcome to stay and talk, but you're officially excused. So thank you very much for your comments. And you are welcome to stay with me and visit, but I need to officially...